Hi, everyone, and welcome to the live fundraising success webinar, Data, Data Everywhere, Mining for Gold in Your Donor Database, sponsored by Results Plus. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success, and your host for today's event. Most organizations have a ton of information on donors, but what can and should you do with it? This session will discuss the kind of information to gather and how to make the most of it to optimize your fundraising success. But before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions both during and at the end of the hour, but mostly at the end. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and the bells and the whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on the console do and how you can customize your experience today. Okay, with that out of the way, let's meet our speakers for the webinar. Here today to discuss how to make the most of the information in your donor database, we have Amanda Reinerts, Manager of Product Development at Metafile, Jody Scheib, Vice President of Fundraising at DMW Direct, and Joe Hamilton, Director of Development at Frinsic & Friars. And with all of that said, let me turn this over to Jody.
Well, thank you very much, Margaret. It is so nice to be here, and I really do appreciate you inviting me to speak today about one of my very favorite topics, which is data. People ask me all the time why I'm so obsessed with data and why it's always the first thing that I talk about. And I think it's because it has changed so much from when I started in this business probably 15 or so, I should cough and say that under my breath, 15 or so years ago. Data was really, when we talked about data, we talked about name and address, and that was pretty much it. And then we got a little bit more sophisticated, and maybe we were talking a little bit about how much they last gave, maybe even when they last gave. But nowadays, it's a whole new world, and when we talk about data, we talk about really a world of endless possibilities. And there's so much to cover, and for those of you who know me, I really could go on and on, but since they only gave me 20 minutes, I'm going to try and limit what I talk about to three key points, and that's why do we need the data, where do we get it, and when we have it, what do we do with it to really maximize it in our fundraising activities in efforts that will increase our return on investment. So to get started, we're going to talk a little bit about why we need the data. And as the slide shows, and as you all know, I believe, it's because not all of your donors are equal. Not all of them are motivated by the same thing to give to your organization. Not all of them have the same giving capacity, or not all of them want to give through the same avenue or through the same technique. You have donors who prefer to give online and some who prefer to give through telemarketing, some who prefer to participate in your organization through special events and fundraising activities, and others who want to write you a check and send it the old-fashioned way through the mail. Data helps us sift through all of that information to identify what donors on your file prefer each activity, what they can do, and what they want to do. So now, where do we get all of this data? Where does it come from? Well, there's three main ways that we can learn about our donors, and I'd like to spend the majority of my time talking about these three ways, where we can learn the information, and then what we do with it once we learn it. Data appends, self-reported data, and the donor behavior. All of those sources are ways to learn about the individual donors on your file. The first is data appends, and this is something we talk about a lot and we hear a ton about. And like I said, in the old days, data appends were pretty much name and address. Now, if there is information about your donor out there, you can find it. We can tell you whether your donors wear contact lenses, whether they drive an SUV, how many kids they have. We could probably tell you kids that they don't even know they have. We have all of this information, and it's available to you, of course, for a charge. And you could really spend $1 million updating your database with all of these pieces of information. But the question is, do you want to? We could go so far. And I think what I want to leave you here with today about data append specifically is just because you can learn this information doesn't mean that you should. And I think that that's a really important point. And I don't know if you can read this what's supposed to be a humorous letter in your screen, but it's an example of an organization who takes the data that they've appended on their file and they take it way too far by sharing way too much information about that, showing off to their donor that they know how old they are and how much their sister gave and where they work and probably their blood type. Just because you can learn this information doesn't mean you want to spend the money on it and doesn't mean you should use it. So how do you know what it is you should get on your file, where you should get it, and then how you should use it? I'll tell you a little story. We found we had an organization call us up because they got a promotional piece from a company that does data appends, and it said that they could append vehicles on their file. We could find out exactly what vehicles their donors drove. So they called and said that they thought that was really, really cool, and they wanted to do that. So what they think they're going to do is append the data and then find a car company to donate a car and do a sweepstakes using the car as a giveaway. So they took a piece of data that you could append to your file and created a marketing plan around that. And that's, in our opinion, completely backwards. What you want to do is create a goal for the year, or look at the goals for your year, and then what do you need to accomplish your goals? If a data append is available for what you need to accomplish, then you move that way. So first you have your goal, and then you see what you need to append to it. And I want to give you a couple of examples. And these won't work for every organization, but I'm sorry, I just got a little note that I'm sounding a little low, so I'll try and speak up a little bit. They're not going to work for every organization, but perhaps some of these might be relevant for your organization. So if you're an organization and your goal is to grow your planned giving program, you might want to consider an age append. We have many organizations that will do an age append and then select donors of a certain age to promote their planned giving program. Or if your organization is, for example, building a playground in your neighborhood, or you're a health organization and you're creating a fund to fight childhood obesity or childhood cancer, perhaps you want to do a data append that talks about the presence of children in a household and create a marketing plan around that. Once you identify which of your donors have children in their household, you can either solicit just to them, or you can tailor and customize your communications to talk about knowing that they have kids in their household. Another example would be many organizations look at their file and want to invest money in upgrading donors. So you might want to consider an income append so you can see the capacity of giving. A quick word of caution, in our experience, those, all because somebody makes, you know, $500,000 a year doesn't mean that they're going to donate any more than somebody who gives $10,000 a year. So while income appends are very popular and can help you select who has the capacity to give to your major giving and or capital campaign, it's not always the best indicator. Some organizations are having fulfillment troubles, so they want to increase their credit card rate. You could append credit card usage, data on credit card usage, and perhaps use a credit card incentive to those donors who have a high affinity to use their credit cards. And those, again, are just four examples, but the idea is identify what it is you want to accomplish and then see if there's data available out there that will help you reach your goal, as opposed to doing it the other way around. But really, just to wrap up the data appends, the sky's the limit on the data that you can append to your file. Really, if you think it, you can append it. So just look out there if there's something that you think will help you reach your goal, and there probably is. Of course, there's a price for all of that, but there's probably data available.
Jody, this is Margaret. Can I just break in for a second? One of our attendees has asked you to please define data append.
Okay, a data append is when you go to a third-party source and purchase data on your donors. So you send them the information on your donors, and they give you the data. So say it's presence of children in households. You ask for that, or you can order it in a bucket, like 10 different pieces of data, and they send you which donors on your file have children in their household. They can look at John Smith and say he makes $120,000 a year or $50,000 a year, and you can append that back to your database. And of course, that depends on what kind of database you have and how to append it, but your database can help you out with that. The idea is to purchasing data, outside data, on learning more about your donors.
Can I add one brief thing about that? If
please.
I might real quick. Besides purchasing it, and we'll mention this later, but just I'll throw it in real quick right now in case I were to forget it later. You can license that or sort of rent it in a sense where a third party could sort of house your data, because we did this, and you have those data appends as long as you're paying the service to provide them, so they never actually deliver it to you into your database, which you can do. And if you discontinue payment to that service, then they discontinue providing the data appends sort of in real time. So there's a couple of ways to do that, but it gets at the same thing.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. So continue on.
Absolutely. Thank you. Another way to learn about your donors is self-reported data. So this is when your donor is pretty much telling you what they like, telling you anything about themselves, whether or not it's their age or what motivated them to give to your organization. It's your donors raising their hands and saying something about themselves. I'm going to caution you on using this type of data too much in your program. I don't know anybody who has raised their hand and said, I donated to XYZ organization because they sent me these really cool labels. But we know that for many organizations, it's those labels that generate the most response. So I'm not saying people aren't always honest, but I think that they're not always the best at identifying what motivates them to give. So while you track this data and you have this data on your database, I would definitely flag it as self-reported data. I think there's probably an organization out there that would tell you that I told them that I was 21 years old, but I'm certainly not 21 years old. So there's not always 100% accuracy in what you'll see in self-reported data. When the donor mail preferences is when a donor calls your organization and says, I don't want to receive any mail from you. I only want to receive email, and I'll give to you via email. Or only send me one piece of mail per year. Any donor communication about how they want to be communicated with is also self-reported data, and oftentimes not the most reliable indicator of what they want either. We've had many organizations who have tested those groups of people who say, don't mail me, only email me. And after not mailing them for a year, they'll begin to mail them again on a limited basis, and they'll respond huge. So even the donor mail preferences, a donor saying what they want in terms of their communication preferences, isn't 100% accurate or the best indicator of how they're going to respond. Okay. The third, and what I think is the funnest, of the three ways to acquire information about your donors is through their behavior. There's many types of organizations on the line, I know, so many types of behavior that might be relevant for each of you. The number one indicator of a donor's capacity or willingness to give again is their RFM. Their RFM score, and you'll hear about this a ton if you don't already know what it is. It's when they last gave a gift, how many gifts they've given, and how much they've given. Those three factors combined are the single most indicative factor of whether or not a donor will contribute to your organization again. So everything else that we're talking about is terrific, and it's just one more way to communicate and to segment on your file. But this one score is, you want to make sure that you have a good handle on your donor's RFM scores. If you have a file with 100,000 lapsed donors, for example, and you only want to send 10,000, but you want to send a high-end piece that's going to be costly, and you want to increase the average gift, you're going to take a look at that RFM score first. See who's most recently given a gift and how much they've given. Perhaps you don't want to mail it to somebody who's only given $20, $25 in the past. You want to make sure that you're looking at that score in terms of who you're mailing. These other things, donor-initiated interactions, is when a donor calls you and says, hey, I moved. Here's my new address. Even if it's a complaint, hey, I don't like what you sent me in your newsletter last week, or you send me too much email. Any of those interactions that a donor initiates, it's really that donor raising their hand saying that they care about your organization. It takes no time at all for a donor to throw something in the mail. It takes time for them to call you and tell you what they think of it. So try and flag those and track those in your database. Usually we'll see those people who have called to change their address or even called to complain are really good responders. The history with the organization, if you're a university or higher education organization, and the history is that they're a graduate, so what school did they graduate from? When did they graduate? If you're a hospital, are they a parent? Are they a patient? Are they a donor? That kind of, what's the history with your organization above and beyond their fundraising history? Do they volunteer? Typically, donors who volunteer either are great planned giving opportunities or they're very passionate and they're consistent donors to your organization. So these are all pieces of data and pieces of information that you should track in your database. Are they a run participant? Do you do annual runs, and do they participate in that? Is that the only time they participate with your organization? Well, you can make sure that they're only receiving information about those. And finally, acquisition list data. A lot of our organizations are keeping on their file and using as a data point what type of acquisition rental list the donor was on. So if you're doing acquisition mail, and you know that Jane Smith was on the Environmental Defense Fund list, you keep that as a data point in their file. Under Jane Smith, it says, you know, Environmental Defense Fund, perhaps. And in future communications, you can customize that, if appropriate and when appropriate, to her affinity to the Environmental Defense Fund. So all of these types of behaviors that your donors acting on and that they're participating in and their relationship with your organization should be captured in your database and used for communications. I'm going to show you just a couple of examples of how some organizations use this data in their communications. So the first example is from a public television station in Austin, Texas, and they capture every bit of information about their donors. This is their membership organization, so this is their first hit of their member renewal series. And I don't know how well you can see it, but we do a variable data printing piece where if the donor is interested in children's programming, they have not only children's images, but the headline there is based on children's programming. There's probably 18 buckets for this renewal series. If you're an Antiques Roadshow, you get Antiques Roadshow images. Cooking, there's Austin City Limits. There's a huge variety of interests based on what the programs these donors have watched and have given to before. And that's how we motivate them to give again. We talk a lot about what their program specifically is, what they like, how much it costs, and where their gift is going to support it. So that's what the front piece looks like. The back of the piece is also personalized based on data. So if they're a sustainer prospect, and that's somebody we've identified based on many factors of their RFM, so how many gifts have they given in their lifetime? Are they a high-dollar giver, a low-dollar giver? We flag people as sustainer conversion prospects, and on their communications, they receive a piece of sustainer information. They call it their green membership. If they're not a sustainer prospect, they receive a program survey so that we can capture more self-reported data. Because self-reported data, while not 100%, is certainly better than no data at all. So that is one example. A second example is from an organization called Semester at Sea, and they are exactly what they sound like. They take students off for a semester at sea on a boat, and they have their learning and their semester while traveling the world. I wish this was around when I was in college because it sounds like a good time, but it's a very strenuous academic program, I'm assured. What they have done for their annual giving program is they have sent maximum personalization in their appeals. If you were a student, you not only have the picture of the particular boat that you were on for your semester at sea and the name of that boat, as well as the year you were on that boat. Your ask amount is varied based on the year that you graduated. There are assumptions based on the giving behaviors of, you know, 20-somethings versus 30-somethings versus 40-somethings and their capacity to give. So ask amount is based on that. they have different letters and different copies whether the person is a student, a graduate, whether they were a parent of a student, whether they were a teacher or a faculty member, and that's the constituent type. All of that's personalized to be able to tailor the giving argument to what the donor or the prospect is going to be most interested in. We think your commercial entities do this all the time. We see Amazon, for example, when you purchase something, you then get an email that says, you purchased the XYZ. Perhaps you'd be interested in the ABC or the DEF. And they talk to you like they know you. And that's exactly what we're talking with all of this data. Let your donor know that you know them and that you know what's important to them and that you know who they are in your organization. And finally, you can be the smartest fundraiser in the world with the best strategies and the most detailed data segmentation plan, but it won't be successful at all if the mail, the email, the phone call, if it doesn't get to your donor. So it's very important to make sure, I love animation on slideshows, it's very important to make sure that you NCOA your file regularly, that's the National Change of Address, to make sure that you have the most up-to-date address, that if you have a robust email marketing program, that you're doing e-appends on your file. People change email, you know, more often than my children change their socks. You have to be e-appending your file on a regular basis to make sure that it's getting into your donor's computer. Make sure that you have clean data in your donor base, and I think that's what we're going to be talking about for the next session is how to do that and how to maintain that. But all of these strategies and all of this segmentation is terrific, but it doesn't do anything if you're not reaching your donors. So I think that's the most important thing. And just want to thank you guys for your time and for listening, and here's my contact information. So if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to give me a call or send me an email. Margaret, I'll throw it back to you.
Hello, Jody.
Yes.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I'm having some technical difficulties with my computer, but I have been told that we have some questions about RFM, and can you just explain what that stands for, and then we'll move into our other speakers.
Sure, absolutely. So RFM, I know I talk about how important it is for such a long period of time, but don't think I really talked about what it was. So RFM is a combination of the R is recency, frequency is the F, and the monetary is the M. So recency is when the donor last gave a gift. Frequency is how many gifts has that donor given to your organization. And monetary is how much have they given. So when you're looking at, there are many organizations, I'll back up, that segment your database and will flag people based on this as a most likely to respond donor. If you are sending a lapsed mailing and or a follow-up piece to a lapsed mailing and you want to target the most likely to respond, you're going to use RFM. So based on your budget and whatnot, you're going to look at your lapsed file and say, okay, recency. I want to make sure their most recent gift is within 48 months. So that will be one criteria, that they're not more than 48 months lapsed. The frequency, okay, I don't want somebody who only gave once. They have to have at least more than one gift to our organization in their lifetime. And the monetary could be, well, you know, I'm sending out a label and a notepad. This is a pretty expensive piece. I'm looking for a higher than normal average gift. Let's only send to people whose individual gifts per year are greater than $40 or $20 or whatever is appropriate for your organization. You take those three factors and you use them to segment who you're mailing to. I'm not sure if that answered it completely or not, but
okay, well, we will we'll try to get back to that toward the end if we have any further questions, but let's move on and continue with Amanda and Joe, and in the meantime, I will try to solve my technical difficulties.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret. My name is Amanda Mellinger-Reinartz. I'm with Metafile Information Systems, and today we also have Joe Hamilton, who is the Director of Development at the Franciscan Friars. And so he and I will kind of be chatting back and forth with one another and specifically talking to some of what Jody has already mentioned. And then Joe will be providing real-life experience as he's encountered these things and as he's worked through many of these data aspects in his everyday life. So, Joe, would you like to say hi?
Hello. I'll gladly speak about RFM and much of what Jody spoke about. Very, very appropriate, and answer any questions, too.
Excellent. So then just kind of a little bit of information here before we start. There's my contact information as well as Joe's in case anybody is curious and would like to get a hold of us later. That's not a problem at all. Then we're going to move right into you are spending all of this time and effort. Maybe you've done some data appends. Maybe you have been gathering self-reported data. Maybe it's sometimes self-reported data. Jody made a really good point that it's not terribly reliable. Sometimes what you might want to think of instead of self-reported data is actual actions that they've taken in the past and use that. But regardless of all of this information you've been gathering, in addition to whether or not you can mail to these folks, you want to make sure that data is clean. And the reason for that is so that you're not spending extra money, so that you're not accidentally increasing the cost of your efforts. So what can you do to keep your data clean? Probably one of the biggest things is to deduplicate your data regularly. Duplicates, they get into your system. They get in a number of ways. And we'll talk about that here in just a moment. But the things to keep in mind are that make it a regular part of your activities. It's not something that you want to put off until the end of the year and then discover you have a lot of data that you wish you had been on top of throughout the month. So make it a monthly priority. Maybe it's at the end of the month. Maybe it's at the beginning of the month. But spend some time to dedupe your data. Another good time to do that is prior to each major mailing. You want to make sure that you start it in advance of when you're planning to do that mailing so that it can be done before your drop date. But it's a good idea to check your data, make sure it's clean before each major mailing as well. And another thing that I will recommend to some customers, and this it doesn't necessarily work for every organization, but another thing to keep in mind is to maintain a list of potential deletes. It's possible that you have some names that have gotten into your database that maybe aren't good candidates for anything. And as you identify them, just kind of some systems will allow you to flag them, mark them, and then maybe that's something to bring up, maybe quarterly, annually, whatever works for your organization. But take a look at those folks and see if maybe you shouldn't simply remove them from your database. Good candidates for that would be people who have never responded to anything, people that you're not even sure quite how they got in there. So those are some options. Another option would be, you know, instead of getting rid of folks, let's say that they were actually a donor for quite a while, or they were a volunteer, and they've passed away, or they've lapsed in some way. In those cases, depending on what your goal is for your mailing, you may be better served to simply flag them as deceased or inactive, but not actually remove them from your data. And at that point, what I'd like to do is kind of provide just a couple of quick tips on how to dedupe that data, and then I'm going to throw it over to Joe because he's got some really good advice from what he's learned. Those tips would be when you're looking for those duplicates, start with a really narrowly defined set of criteria. And by that, what I mean is to say the first name is the same, the last name is the same, the address 1 is the same, the zip plus 4 is the same, for example. The reason for that is what you don't want to do is say, well, just find everybody with the same last name who lives in the same city, which probably is never a good idea, but that's just an example of what's not a good option there. And the reason you want to start with the more narrowly defined is so that you can find those records that are very obviously duplicates. You can almost automate that system. Let your software just clean those up for you automatically. Then take another pass through where you've expanded the criteria to catch records that might be duplicates. Those ones are going to require some human intervention and some thought. And they may or may not be duplicates at the end of the day, and that's why it requires a little bit of intellectual effort. And that's one of the things that I'm going to throw over to Joe here because he can talk quite a bit about that. Joe, if you would, please.
On what we do a large national, large-ish, mid-sized probably, national direct mail program, And so it's fairly high volume with acquisition. And so the data comes in, the main way that we get data that's not very is through the acquisition process. You know, the lists come in, you do a merge purge, which is the best way to, if you're doing acquisition, your mail house or whomever you're working with, and even if you yourself are doing it, some agency, to merge purge, where they combine all the lists, the acquisition lists together to purge out duplicates before you mail it, of course. And but at that stage, quite often, the way the name is, they might be on your file, and the merge purge process doesn't catch them. And this is going to happen no matter how well you try to purge out duplicates from acquired lists that you use. It's just going to get through. And what you're trying to do is minimize the amount of cleanup that you have to do later, that Amanda was talking about. We do that regularly, monthly, exactly as Amanda describes it. And for the most part, the obvious ones, the exact same names, they don't get through quite as much, but you'll get very similar ones. The trickier ones are mother and son, father, son, apartment buildings. The one thing we don't do, and this she was talking about potential deletes, so we never delete names from once we get them, largely because if we've acquired them, more than likely, except in the rare occasion, as Amanda suggested, when you're never quite sure how you got the name, maybe they just wrote into you or something, put me on your mailing list. But in our case, the vast majority of names we get are through exchange or rental lists. And if I've paid for them in one capacity or another, even if they never give, I've at least already paid for them, quote unquote, in some capacity already. So I'd rather not do that again. And I can mail to them as lapsed or as prospects, again, sort of internal prospects. But if I delete them, then what will wind up happening is I'll acquire them again, rent them again somehow, when I really don't need to.
Excellent. Thanks, Joe. So what we're going to do here is just kind of move on to the next slide, which is one of those things where, okay, I need to clean my data, but how do I keep getting these into my system? And as Joe mentioned, no matter how hard you try, when you're acquiring lists, sometimes they just get in there. Another option would be sometimes people move and then they give again with a new address, and it wasn't clear to you if they managed to do that in between your NCOA updates. Wasn't really clear to you that they were not the donor that you already had, so those can get in, and those are great options for records that should just be merged together. And then one of the ways that I'm seeing more and more duplicates get into system is with online giving. It's and I'm not saying this to be negative to donors, because I think I do it myself. I never manage to enter my own address the same way twice. So sometimes they'll just accidentally get into your system because the person gave you their address two different ways. So that can happen. And so this is just one of the things to keep in mind, that this is how these people get in and why it's an ongoing need to continually clean your data. So now that we know that our data is clean, what are we going to do with it? Using it, that's one of the biggest keys, and some of this will be tagging onto what Jody had mentioned earlier, and hopefully it will cement for you just exactly how important these pieces of information are and in what ways you can use them. Now, obviously, segmentation is a pretty wide open concept, and you can do it a number of ways. You could do it by interest categories if perhaps you're just looking for volunteers who may want to come and spend time at a specific event. You may want to know, you know, who has historically shown to be interested in volunteering versus just writing a check, for example. Another would be gender. If you're doing something that for some reason is gender-based, you'll find, for example, I know that a women's shelter here in Rochester is doing a Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, which while women are certainly welcome to join, it's actually targeted towards men. to come and walk a mile in heels. So that might be a way that you want to do that. Past campaign responses, of course. Age, as Jody had mentioned, especially when it comes to planned giving prospects. Giving ranges, you know, whether or not this is a donor who gives consistently in smaller amounts or a donor who maybe gives once every 2 years but a nice large amount. If they've received services from your organization, they may make a great candidate for a specific type of communication. And then, as Jody mentioned, RFM, the recency, frequency, and monetary. And that is a real key. She highlighted it, and Joe will highlight it again here in a little bit about how that is one of the most predictive ways to segment your data and be able to figure out what kind of a response rate you can get. And there are a couple of ways to do a RFM. In the for-profit world, it's frequently done by quintiles where they'll take, for recency, they'll divide your database into five different segments. They'll do the same thing for frequency, and then they'll do the same thing for monetary. And what you end up with at the end of the day is 125 potential segments, not necessarily that you want to use all of them, because, or maybe you do, but that's kind of how that all comes together. And, yes, there are absolutely services that do it. The good news is today most software vendors, most of your CRM systems, your donor management systems, will also be able to do that for you. With nonprofits, an approach is a little more specific than that, where you're not necessarily just doing the flat 20% of each option, where you're better able to define what is important for your organization in these ranges. So maybe it's 0 to 6 months, or maybe it's 0 to 18 months, and then 18 to 36. However, you can define what those different groups are so that you can create your own segments. Well, you can define them and then have the software create them for you so that you then just have to query out one specific value. So that's another key aspect. And again, you're going to hear RFM coming up over and over. And with that, I'm actually going to ask Joe if he could talk a little bit about that and what your experience has been. I know you had mentioned that you've done a lot of different types of analysis, and in the end, you kind of come back to that.
Yes. First, I'd like to commend Jody on her whole presentation, because it was everything our organization lived through, and I thought it was excellent. So I sometimes think of the RFM, which we'll talk about in a moment a little more, but RFM sort of for a very long time. I've been doing this for 13 years. So from the time I started working with data for us, till now, RFM had been sort of the base level of how you'd work with your data to predict performance, in our case, fundraising, giving. And then a number of years back, this may have happened even longer in the for-profit world, but in at least the little nonprofit world that I'm involved in, I began hearing talk of this thing called analytics, business intelligence. I'd start to hear about data appends and all of this other ways that the new tools could crunch the data and tell me more. So I became very interested in that and thought, well, there must be more than just recency, frequency, and monetary to tell me. There must be age and income and ethnicity and home ownership and the contact lenses and all of that. So I did. We engaged a firm to help us do all of that, and spent a number of years, about 2 to 3 years, as it were, looking at it by age, you know, the last 3 years of our direct mail appeals by different age cohorts to see were there differences if you were 18 to 24 than if you were, you know, 64 to 75 or whatever those different sets of age cohorts we used then was. We looked at it in just a myriad of ways using the data appends, all of those sort of demographic pieces of information. And we found all sorts of information. There was an awful lot of variety. But it turned out for our particular organization that really, truly, none of those demographic pieces were especially predictive. Any more so, I'll put it this way, they had their predictive value, but they were not more predictive than the RFM, the original thing we were doing anyway, and that I didn't need to hire this extra firm to help us with. So all of that being said, the data appends can be incredibly useful. And I'll give one example for us. The very first thing we ever did with the data append was age. We kept hearing over and over the anecdotes about the aging of, we're Roman Catholic religious order, the Franciscans. And so I kept hearing over and over again the aging of our file and sort of this coming storm, if you will, or catastrophe of the aging of our file. And lo and behold, it turns out that 44% of my file was 75 years of age or older. So I no longer had it anecdotally. I had hard data that there was indeed a coming storm of the, sort of this aging of my file, and that's only gotten worse over the last 3 or 4 years. There wasn't a whole lot I could do with that, quite honestly, and some of the other pieces, but what that did was motivate me to learn more about it and figure out how to get this data working very well, particularly the RFM. Quite honestly, it's the most predictive thing we know of. And the way we do it, just in the for-profit world, they do, I believe, use these quintiles. And it's in one sense, it's more or less what we do, except for recency, you're basically defining how far back from today. If you're doing a list select today for a mailing you're going to do a month from now, as of the day that you're looking at your data, you're trying to determine, going back in time, the recency is, if their last gift was between now and, in my case, 3 months ago, that's one recency segment. If it was between 4 and 6 months ago, that's another recency segment. 7 and 9 months ago, that's a segment. 10 and 12 months ago. Therefore, if their gift was in the last 12 months, I actually have four different segments to determine that, and they all perform slightly differently in terms of response rate. Add to the recency is the frequency. Did they give you a single gift? That means they came on at some point. If they were their single gift and it was 4 to 6 months ago, well, that tells me they're in that segment. Did they give multiple gifts? What we do is we define a single gift, a multiple gift, and a what I call an M4. That is, have they given four or more gifts? You could define it any way you want. We just happen to have arrived at that that distinction. And they all perform differently. Lastly, the monetary. You could use highest previous gift, and there are periods in our time when we did that. So I would say, was the donor's highest gift ever? Not their last gift, their highest gift ever, $5 to $9.99. That's one segment. $10 to $14.99, that's another segment. $15 to $24.99, and you can work your way up. You could make it as broad or as narrow as you want. The more segments you have, in a sense, just the more clutter you might have. So you only want as many segments as you can kind of use. But you do want as many segments as can be meaningful for you. So, for instance, given the segmentation rationale that I just explained, I could tell you that if a donor is 0 to 3 months, their last gift was 0 to 3 months, they have given four or more gifts ever. That's not just within the last 3 months. That's ever in the lifetime. And their monetary, it doesn't even matter. They can be a $5 donor. They can be a $100 donor. The key indicator there for response rate for us is the first two things. The more recent a donor is, the more likely they are to give. You'll see that's an ironclad law. You'll see it month in and month out. Our board sometimes, when we mail a lot, there have been times in the past when our board would say, well, don't you think that you should give people a rest sometimes? You know, maybe once or twice a year. What they were getting at is this sense that you can mail too often, which you can, but what they weren't realizing is that, and that you're mailing too quickly. And then you'd have to show them the spreadsheet and show them that the people who gave within the last 3 months are the highest givers always because they're just more familiar with you. It's more recent to them. So your goal is to try to keep people as recent in giving as you possibly can. And as well, frequency, that's easy to understand. If you've given one gift, you're not really a donor yet. Plenty of times you give a gift to something, and it's just how it hit you that day, and you're not bonded to that organization truly or that cause. A second gift, maybe you're getting closer. But if you get a third, if you get a fourth gift, you can almost get 40 gifts at that point, because four gifts to the same organization truly means they've hit your radar and you as donor kind of have begun to care about them. So if you're given very recently and you've given a lot over your lifetime, that would tend to indicate that you're a pretty good donor. So it would make sense that regardless of whether you are $5, because that's where your income level is, or $500, by dint of your recency and frequency, you're going to give a lot. And that becomes very predictive. Once you know how many people fit in that segment, if you have 200 people in that segment or 2,000 people in that segment, once you get a few different appeals or campaigns or whatever the campaign is, once you get a few bits of data over time, you'll see, at least we've always seen, that it becomes very consistent as how those segments perform, reasonably consistent, and consistent enough to be able to have some kind of predictive power for budgeting, which for me is what it was all about. How can I know I'm going to do 10 mailings next year? How can I estimate what they might make? If you have segments like that and some giving history, then you absolutely can have something that's reasonably consistent enough to make some predictions.
Excellent.
I'll pause there.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's great. And then you look like the smartest guy in the room, because you know exactly how much it's going to cost. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, the costs are much easier to predict than income. But yeah, you can, at least there's a rationale. You're not making it up. And while it might not be exactly right, you now have another data point to look at. Well, why didn't that work? Did the mail drop late? There are a host of reasons you could then begin to look at why it didn't play out the way it had been, and you'll almost always arrive at it, an actual reason why it didn't meet the expectations.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Joe. Mm-hmm. In addition to RFM, you may have a few other segmentation options. Again, some of this kind of goes back to some of the things Jody had mentioned early on. Perhaps you want to use this data to qualify potential monthly givers. Maybe you know that somebody's given for the past 5 years to your organization and they tend to give 3 or 4 times a year. Using that data, they might be good candidates for a mailing where you're targeting looking for sustaining givers. Make it easy for them so that you can have income that you can count on. You know it's just going to happen. It makes it easier on you. It makes it easier on your donor. So there's an option. The other things would be if you know that people who have given to a specific campaign and you're actually kind of curious as to why, let's say that you hadn't done a lot of upfront work because, for example, maybe this data is just older. Query for similarities. One of the things you can do is if you can learn how to query your CRM or donor management system, you can identify trends. You can actually do a little bit of mining to find some of those trends that you may not have known were there. Another option for using your data is non-solicitation communication. Perhaps people who've responded to a campaign, you just want to send them an update, further that relationship with that particular donor. Birthday cards, if you know their age, when their birthday is. Invites to events, of course. Another one would be giving levels. If perhaps you're wanting to, you know that they have historically given at a specific level and you want to see if maybe you can help them move to the next level, you may be able to use some of that information. One key piece of that, and I think, you know, Jody had a slide in there that said, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I like to think of that as don't be creepy. Sometimes just because you know this information, and you may even be able to use it internally, you don't necessarily want to externalize that you know it, just because it might be creepy. the other thing, kind of moving right along here because we're running out of time, is the idea of generating more data. Perhaps you're curious about, well, I've got all this information in here, and Joe has mentioned a lot of the work they've done. What can I do with some of this? One example would be doing A-B testing, with your mailings, maybe you want to test your message, your inclusions, what sort of premiums you're including. Another one would be testing your email subject lines. That's easy to do, and it helps you kind of figure out what to do with the rest of that segment. So you pick you pick your target, and then you choose, you randomly identify a small segment of that, and again, your donor management system, your CRM, should actually be able to generate a randomized subset of your data for you so that you can then do this without a ton of effort. And then I'm going to kind of throw this back to Joe for one last comment, and it's going to be this last slide here. And if I can get there. Joe, can you talk a little bit about if you only take away one thing from this?
Yes. Whatever querying tool your software has, and they all have to have something like that, to ask questions of your data, learn how to use it, or have someone on the staff learn how to use it, because it's the single greatest thing you have available to you. It's not necessarily reporting. Sometimes reporting might be another thing. It's a little more advanced sometimes, reports. But even query, how many people do I have on my file whose prefix is FR, period, father? Okay, we're Roman Catholic. So if I'm trying to find how many people I want to mail to, and that's that, or how many people is Colonel and Mrs., it sounds simple, but if you don't actually know how to ask that of your database and get that information back out, even just to think about what you might do in the future, you kind of have an arm tied behind your back.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I want to say thank you to our speakers and apologize to our audience because I was having some technical difficulties. We do have a few questions. Unfortunately, I can't get to the Q&A section, so I've asked Fundraising Success Managing Editor Joe Boland to step in. He'll be moderating our questions. We have a few minutes for a couple of questions. So, Joe, if you don't mind, could you take it away?
Sure. Well, for starters, here's one. How often should people, you know, do their EAPENs and the NFCA for their data? You know, what is a regular basis?
Amanda here. The answer to that is somewhat it depends, although not entirely. There are benefits to having your change of address done more frequently if you're a heavy mailer. I believe it's every 90 days to have decreased costs if you're mailing to the United States Postal Service. If you're a less frequent mailer, I would say before every major mailing. Joe, do you have better advice for that?
No, that's it.
Okay, great.
And another question here is then how do you keep your RFM scores current? Do these scores need to be run more than once on the donor database?
Hi, this is Jody. I'll take that one. Certainly they do because their RFM is always changing. If you're running them, if you're going to an outside source to give your file a score, we typically see organizations that do it quarterly. Of course, it all depends on your budget. The more frequent you mail, you might want to make sure that it's up to date before every mailing. If you're only mailing once or twice a year, I think doing it right before your mailing to be able to fine-tune and get the data in there is perfectly sufficient.
And there's a lot of questions here too about kind of recommending the best software. Maybe what nonprofits should look for when they're choosing a software to run all of their data against.
I'm probably a little biased on this one since I work for a vendor, but I'm going to keep it pretty high level here. I would say that when you're looking for a software vendor, what you want is one that sort of naturally contains the basics of the information, which all of them do. So that doesn't really rule anybody out, except that it might rule out somebody, some very, very small homegrown one. Aside from that, you look and see if they can automate the RFM scoring for you, especially if you're a heavy mailer, and a number of them do, not all of them, but a number of them do. Another option would be how do they help you with the NCOA updates? Do they have services available, or do they have an easy way to get the data out and into your system? Again, some are easier or more difficult than others, but that's certainly a component of it. And then depending on how fancy you get with some of your data appends, if you're starting to append data that may be considered a bit of a one-off, so that perhaps, let's take Jody's example where you want to know what vehicle they're driving. That's probably not stored by default in any CRM system. So what you're going to look for in that case is one that will allow you to customize some of that or create new spaces for some of that information. And more importantly than that, when you create that new space, can you use it in queries? And if you can, go for it. Joe and Jody, do you have some additional input there?
I would also, I see a lot of organizations that are really large organizations but that use a database that was really created for smaller organizations and vice versa. I would call some of your counterparts of similar size and sophistication in their marketing efforts and see what they're on, what they like, and what they don't like about it. For every organization is going to want something different in their database. But if you talk to people and you have something in mind, you know, say that querying is your hot button, you want to be able to query names easily and you want multiple people in your organization to be able to do it, call people around and ask how easy the query tool is. Other people, reporting is really important and they want to do back-end analysis and they want a sophisticated reporting tool, while some organizations don't do that at all and use a totally different system for that. So your needs and desires are going to be different, but if you call some organizations of a similar size and ask them about what it is you're looking for and if their database matches, there's so many choices out there, but you'll find one that's perfect for you.
And there's also a few questions here about A-B testing. Can you just kind of briefly explain what A-B testing is and how that relates?
Sure. A-B testing is where you put together, I'm going to use an email, for example, because it's an easy one that the typical testing tends to be pretty basic on, where maybe what you want to do is test how effective your subject line is, whether or not people open your message. I mean, a lot of times the problem with email is that people don't even read it. You know, if you can get them to read it, then you have a different set of concerns, but we have to get them to read it first. Well, after we get it delivered, but we're going to set that one aside for a moment. So the A-B testing would be you want to test, let's say you want to test, I'm going to keep it simple. Maybe you actually want more than two, but we're going to go with A and B. So you want to test two different subject lines to see which one is more effective. Now, let's say that this email, when you're ready to actually roll out the email live, so to speak, you're actually going to email it to 2,000 people. You have 2,000 names. Well, when you're doing the A-B testing, you're going to want to get a small subset of that. Let's say that you want to test 10% of that. So you'd be dropping that down to 200 people of your subset. And you're going to want to then, of that 200 people, you're going to want to have those broken down into two 100-person groups so that 100 random people get message subject line A and the other 100 random people get subject line B. Now, granted, these numbers are small and yours are probably different than this. Then you send out your email with the two different subject lines, and then you analyze the data that comes back. How effective was it at getting people to open it? And then whichever one wins, that's the one you send out to your other 1,800 people in your 2,000-person segment. Does that make sense? I'm hoping that clarifies it. And Jody, perhaps you have a way that you describe it that's clearer.
I'm not sure I think that was clear, but for any A-B testing, it's more of a statistically significant, fair way to test two techniques or two strategies. If you're looking at direct mail, for example, and you have a control piece and you want to test a totally brand new creative package, your control piece would be an A. You'd split your file randomly, and your control would be the A, and the test segment would be the B. When we talk about A-B testing, that's what we're usually referring to, is a random split of your file to test two different strategic techniques or creatives or offers or whatever it is you're testing in your strategy, in your fundraising efforts.
Well, we are just about out of time. I wanted to, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are going to run out of time. I wanted to, on behalf of Fundraising Success and Results Plus, I want to thank everyone for attending today's webinar. I want to thank our speakers for participating and Joe for jumping in and helping out. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And if you would take just a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we would be grateful. Your feedback will help, will influence the webinars that we bring you in the future. Thanks again for joining us, and I hope to see you at the next Fundraising Success webinar.
Thank you.